Marjorie Hines is author of the new book, Priests of Our Democracy, and she, along with Albany law professor and WAMC commentator Stephen Gottlieb, author of the forthcoming Unfit for Democracy, will present their views on the U.S. Supreme Court at Albany Law School next Tuesday on February 26th at 7 o'clock. Hines' book, Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge, covers the battles over academic freedom that played out across college campuses and in the courts in the early 1950s. An activist, lawyer, and journalist, Hines founded and directed the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project, as well as the Free Expression Policy Project, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
It's a delight to have you here, and a delight to be talking about these very important subjects. What brought you to look at these priests of our democracy, if you will?
Priests of our democracy, which actually refers to teachers, not to judges.
Right.
I had been a First Amendment lawyer at the American Civil Liberties Union in the 1990s, and among the Supreme Court cases that I often cited in my briefs, especially in disputes having to do with students, teachers, professors, the whole issue of academic freedom, were these great Supreme Court cases from the 1960s, which culminated in a 1967 case which recognized academic freedom as a special concern of the First Amendment. And these cases really were in response, although belated response, to the McCarthy era of political repression, which hit these schools and colleges especially hard. So when I left being a litigating lawyer and had a little more time, I started to dig into the political and social background. And one thing I discovered was that three of the important Supreme Court cases came out of New York, two out of New York City and one out of New York State, involving the SUNY Board of Trustees and the ways in which they were attempting to implement a very sweeping loyalty program for all public employees, including teachers and professors. So I started digging into the history of it, and the book that resulted is a combination of sort of behind the scenes at the Supreme Court and what was happening to people in the communities, some of the teachers and professors who were caught up in this.
I mean, obviously much of it was the time, but what was it specifically about New York City and even in New York where these teachers and professors became targets of these investigations into their beliefs, their political beliefs, their associations?
New York City had been, since the early part of the 20th century, a hotbed of political radicalism, a lot of trade union activity. The Communist Party, which got started sort of inspired by the Russian Revolution, when people had a lot of as it turned out, unrealistic hopes about the new communist utopia. Communist Party by the 1930s, during the Great Depression, period when there's a lot of fears about fascism both abroad and here, becomes the most dynamic and effective organization on the left, fighting on a whole host of issues from race discrimination to the Spanish Civil War. And New York is really the center of this, partly because it's a big city, partly because there are a lot of immigrants who have come over in the preceding generations with a tradition of labor organizing and radicalism. And so you have, starting really early in the 20th century, you have these upstate-downstate tensions. So the legislature in Albany is frequently passing laws to investigate Reds and subversives and union organizers, and mostly in New York City. And this comes to a head, really, in the longest period of political repression we've had in our country, so-called McCarthy era, really stretching from just after World War II up until the mid-60s.
When we discuss or even define academic freedom, what is in the law and what is just inherent in what it should be?
It really starts, again, in the early part of the century when teachers were getting, professors were getting fired for political activities, mostly supporting labor organizing. And a group of professors comes together in response. The American forms the American Association of University Professors in 1915, and they come out with a statement of principles on academic freedom. And it basically has three parts, and that really hasn't changed very much in the 100 years since. Part one was freedom, and all these freedoms are limited. They're not absolute, obviously. So freedom in the classroom doesn't mean you can go off and teach biology when you're assigned to teach literature, but it does, it incorporates the notion that in order to educate, to properly educate, teachers and especially professors at higher education have an obligation, and this is where the notion of priests of our democracy comes, to open people's minds, to teach them how to think, not just what to think. So freedom in the classroom is one. Freedom in your research and scholarship and writings to pursue knowledge wherever it may lead and challenge conventional wisdom, which often turns out to be wrong. And the third part was what they called extramural speech, was freedom to participate in the political process outside of your work. And that third one has sort of been, by this point, incorporated in a more general principle that people should not lose their jobs because they make a political statement, write a letter to the newspaper, and so forth.
How much of
So at this point in our history, the Supreme Court hasn't really interpreted the First Amendment at all. And what you see in the whole century of battles over political repression, teachers' loyalty oaths, and so forth, is this tension between principles of academic freedom, which are generally accepted, certainly at the college level, as a matter of good educational policy, and violations of those principles, and will there be any relief in the courts for that? And it's really not until the 50s and 60s that the Supreme Court starts to incorporate academic freedom into its concept of the First Amendment, at least that as it applies to professors, students as well, who are employed in public universities, because the First Amendment really only restricts what government can do. So you've got two parts to it. You've got educational policy, and you've got the First Amendment right, which, as the book traces, sort of reached its high point of recognition in the late 60s, and since then has had a kind of rocky history in the Supreme Court.
You write in the book very early on that today's war on terrorism has replaced Cold War anti-communism as justification for limiting civil liberties both on campus and off. So certainly you believe that comparisons can be made between what's happening in academia today and the red baiting of the 50s and into the 60s.
Comparisons can be and certainly have been made. I think you have to be careful, and I try to be careful about not overstating the case, because we are not in another McCarthy era. We do not have House and Senate committees roving around the country calling people in and interrogating them about what books they read, what associations they've joined, what petitions they've signed. And we don't have the kind of massive loyalty programs for public employees that we had in the 50s, including, and this is documented in the book, the famous Feinberg Law in New York. But we do have some similarities, and one of them is that the way that the term terrorism is thrown around, and it is a very scary word, the way communism was thrown around in the 50s, and it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And in the 50s, the fears of communism and the anti-communist panic in terms of the threat that domestic communists posed, which was greatly, greatly exaggerated, that was used as a smokescreen often for attacking the civil rights movement, for attacking the labor movement. So you could throw the word around. And similarly here, especially in the years just after September 11th, there's one incident I describe in the book in which the state police of Maryland were conducting surveillance of a variety of political groups, and that's probably not very different from what state police and local police do in a lot of parts of the United States. And among the groups they are surveilling are those who are protesting the Iraq War, those who are protesting the death penalty, environmental groups, and they're collecting names, and they're spying on meetings, and they're sending the names of the leaders, including, as it turned out in Maryland, a couple of nuns, to the FBI to add to their terrorist watch list. So if you define terrorism as anybody who is engaged in political protest and you think might break the law, you can have a very broad definition, and it can certainly have a chilling effect on political dissent.
Well, going back to the time period that you address in this book, it certainly seems that the liberal and progressive movement was being targeted much more. People weren't getting fired for being overly conservative, were they?
In the 50s?
Yeah.
No, they were not.
Right. So it was this, because otherwise too conservative wasn't thought of as radical.
That's right. And, you know, when you think of political repression in the United States, and it has a long history, it is almost exclusively targeting the left.
Yeah.
There were a couple of trials around the World War II period of domestic fascists and Nazis, but the overwhelming thrust of it, and you can just look at J. Edgar Hoover's career, which starts in the early 1920s with the famous Palmer raids, all through the century, and he is targeting people on the left. And to the left of J. Edgar Hoover did not mean you had to be a socialist by any means.
And what's interesting in reading the book is the challenges that faced the left of that time and what they were facing. And as you just indicated in your answer about the comparisons, I mean, are many of the challenges that they face today, and certainly still at very least how they are portrayed.
Well, there's two things to say about the left, the history of the left in the U.S. One is, it's really a tragic history, in my opinion, and I wouldn't be the first historian who said that, because the socialist movement before World War I was a very popular and populist movement. It had a lot of support throughout the country. The Russian Revolution comes. As I mentioned, a lot of people on the left are very inspired by this, and they fall into the trap of believing that the Soviet Union and ultimately Stalin, who in a power struggle becomes the dictator, are a regime to be admired and defended, and this is the utopia. And it was a terrible mistake. It was a disaster for the American left, because at the same time that the Communist Party becomes the dominant voice of the left for at least the decade of the 30s and well into the 40s, They are doing all kinds of wonderful work on civil rights and unemployment and anti-fascism and a whole host of issues. They are also in a party whose leadership is running back and forth to Moscow, basically getting orders from the Soviet Union. And that's why you see, when you look at the history, the flip-flops of the Communist Party line. First, they're anti-fascist, then Stalin signs a non-aggression pact with Hitler, and suddenly they're not anti-fascist anymore. And then Hitler invades the Soviet Union, and then they're anti-fascist again. So it's appalling to look at that history and see the way a lot of very well-intentioned, dedicated people fell into that trap of defending the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, you also have a history of political repression, and the fact that the left continues to be marginalized in this country is largely due to that history, and especially the legacy of the 50s, which is really still with us, because we don't have, even today, a presence, a legitimately accepted presence of left-wing dissent as part of the political spectrum. We have the middle and the right, and without the left sort of pushing for challenge to the status quo, you end up with a kind of stagnation. And I quote a couple of historians at the end of the book who talk about how we have a very narrow range of acceptable political debate in the U.S., and mostly it's sound bites. There's good and evil, there's only two sides, and there's a difficulty in getting any kind of deeper level of discussion. So we are still stagnated on issues that should be resolved, universal health care being one primary example.
Marjorie Hines's book is Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. Hines, an Albany law professor and WAMC commentator, Stephen Gottlieb, will present their views of the U.S. Supreme Court at Albany Law School next Tuesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. You can find out more by going to albanylaw.edu, albanylaw.edu for more information. Marjorie, thank you very much for being with us. It'll be a pleasure to have you in town. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up next, Hollis and Tobias Seaman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.